Hi, and welcome to the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. I am your host, Kat Jepsen, a canine nutritionist with an innate obsession with dogs and the natural ways in which we are driven to live because of them. So, let's get to it. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. I am your host, as always, Kat Jepsen, and my guest today is an integrative veterinarian with over 35 years experience who also specializes in cancer and utilizing a whole body approach. It's Dr. Judy Jacek. Hi, Dr. Judy.
Hello. Pleasure to be here, Kat. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks so much for coming. After receiving her formal education at Colorado State University, including a bachelor's degree in zoology, followed by her doctorate of veterinary medicine degree in 1988, Dr. Judy remained in the Western United States practicing in Idaho, Utah, and then returned to Colorado in 2001, where she owned and operated an integrative medicine practice for 12 years. Dr. Judy then created a more streamlined practice model and increased her specialization in practicing the terrain paradigm, emphasizing the importance of species-appropriate nutrition augmented by nature's aids in healing, including herbs, homeopathy, ozone, and mistletoe, and also highly recommends the use of hands-on modalities such as acupuncture, chiropractic, and massage. Dr. Judy believes that true healing requires supporting not only the physical body, but includes the mental, emotional, and environmental aspects of the pet's terrain, as health is the natural state of the body, and her goal is to help pets regain natural vitality. At present, Dr. Judy is currently working to develop an educational platform to help other veterinarians learn and practice this method of true healing and regain a love of practice. She currently resides in Tennessee with her husband, Chris, their German Shepherd puppy, Rex, two cats, Oscar and Chester, 12 laying hens and a rooster. And her hobbies are gardening, reading and training Rex, who always keeps her on her toes, teaches her unconditional love and can always make her laugh. Welcome, Dr. Judy.
Thank you. That was a mouthful.
Yeah. I love the intros, though. I mean, they do test me. They test me and my speaking abilities. Okay, so before we get down to the questions, the first thing I would like to ask is, did you always know that you wanted to take an integrative and holistic approach to veterinary care? Or was it something that came after like a light bulb moment or something like that?
Yeah, no, it developed as I got on in my career. You know, all veterinarians are trained conventionally in veterinary school, as was I. And I think about, maybe 8 or so years into my career, I started seeing that, you know, what we're doing, you know, you're seeing more and more medical advances, but pets in general really weren't getting healthier. In fact, they were getting sicker in terms of more chronic disease. You know, conventional medicine, if there's a true emergency, your pet gets, you know, hit by a car or it's bleeding or is it broken leg. I mean, yeah, you know, full on conventional, you do what's necessary to stabilize your dog and get them fixed up. But the chronic illness, you know, we started seeing more and more cancer, more and more autoimmune disease, chronic skin, you know, the itchy skin is just so prevalent. So I started just seeing that more and more and just started asking the question, like, there's got to be something more that, you know, we could be doing. And as I think these things work, when we ask questions and are open, then information comes in. And I started to meet people that were more interested in holistic health. I started attracting clients in that were, say, feeding fresh food diets and not wanting to vaccinate as much because I was open to that. And I started learning from my clients and then started going down different avenues of education myself. It's very much self-taught. There's more education now these days for holistic veterinary medicine. When I first started getting into it, there was very little. So you just have to learn, but then you learn from doing. And as I made transitions in my practice, and you just see your patients do better. I mean, that's the bottom line. Once you start to see, okay, look, I'm vaccinating less, doing fewer pharmaceuticals, feeding fresh food, the pets are just getting healthier. I'm not treating it. The ear infections clear up and the itchy skin, you know, clears up or at least gets better. So I just started to see the results, and then there's no turning back, you know, it's a process. And I'm always open to learning new things. But that was, I think, the real turning point is just you see your patients improve so much and you realize this is true healing, and the difference is it's true healing and not just symptoms, not just addressing symptoms, because that's what conventional medicine is in both pets and people. You just, there's a symptom, they're limping, give them a pain med, they stop limping. We fixed it, right? No, you're not getting to the root cause. Why are they limping or why are they itching? So it's not suppressive medicine. It's about getting to the root of the issue and then helping to create true healing.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Your approach to helping our pets heal is whole, as you just mentioned. And that's in the sense like focuses on the physical, mental, emotional, and environmental aspects. I often find that pet parents tend to try and approach health from a single component, usually physical, like you just said, with a focus on symptom reduction, which I assume is largely because, you know, this is how society is conditioned to think and it's how we function and it's what conventional practice does. Can you describe for us what your whole approach looks like and explain why it's so important that we must consider our pets' emotional and mental health as well as their environment when trying to support their health?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, I mean, we do need to address the physical, of course. And so the most important foundation there is healthy nutrition. I am a proponent of raw feeding, but balanced with whole foods, not putting, you know, so many, as you were saying before, so many commercial diets, just put a bunch of synthetic vitamins and minerals in. And that's not health because that's a false sense of security. They're really just a bunch of chemicals. It may not even be bioavailable. So balanced whole food nutrition as a base. But then, you know, we also have to stop any toxins. And I think a lot of people are like surprised to hear that, like, well, I'm not poisoning my pet. Okay, what about the vaccinations? I think vaccinations are incredibly toxic, and I think they're getting way more toxic because I see more and more chronic disease starting earlier and earlier in the lives of pets. The common preventatives, like some heartworm preventative products are not too bad, but definitely the flea and tick products, those are strong neurotoxins. And just general toxins in the environment, you know, are your neighbors spraying weed killer? What's in the water? Anybody that's on municipal water, I know in this country, has chlorine, probably fluoride, and who knows what other chemicals in there. And I think really the foundation of physical health is incredibly simple. It's like we feed species appropriate food and we stop poisoning them, right? Got my words mixed up there. Species appropriate diet and stop poisoning them. And we have physical health if we do those things. It sounds easy, as we were talking before, harder sometimes to convince people of that than we think. But then I do think that's only part of health. There's the emotional, I think spiritual and energetic aspects of the being, just like for us, you know, your emotions really, play a big role. If you're stressed a lot, you know, and your body is in that sympathetic mode where you're like fight or flight mode, that's not healthy. You can only be healthy if your body is able to enter the parasympathetic, the rest and digest mode where your body's relaxed. It's not feeling any threats. Humans get going on that, you know, hamster wheel our days, and you just get so busy and running here and there that your body physiologically is always in that fight or flight mode. And our pets pick up on that. They pick up on where we are. They're so tuned into us energetically that if we're rushing around, always stressed, they're picking up on that energy and they're taking that on, and they're going to be in that more stressed mode because they just want to go outside and go for a walk or play ball or something. And they're looking at their human running around like crazy, and they don't really know, you know, what's going on, and you know, going on in the environment. What's the family situation like? Is it relatively peaceful? I mean, we all, you know, life happens. We all have our relationship dynamics, but all of those things affect our pet and the environment. Like, I think from a mental health perspective, you were talking about this before the podcast, that dogs are dogs. They're not people in dog suits. We need to understand what is the true nature of the dog. You know, they're pack animals. What are their instincts telling them? And I have an 11-month-old German Shepherd puppy who has a ton of energy, and he's constantly just full of shenanigans. But I look at him and say, of course, you know, he needs to be trained. But I also remember he's not necessarily being bad. He's being an 11-month-old puppy, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
What they do. And like, I try to always ask myself, so why is he doing this behavior? You know, is there something, do I need to do better with training? But really, training is communication, right? It's dogs. Yeah. Dogs are just being dogs, no matter what they're doing. They're just doing what a dog does in that point of time. And if we want them to behave differently, we have to understand how to communicate to them what we would like and make it kind of a win-win. You know, I don't believe in harsh punishments or, you know, shock collars, things like that. I think there's better ways to train. And so that mental health, I think it's just like any relationship, it's about that communication and remember that pets pick up on our emotions. You know, I work with a lot of cancer patients, and it's very fearful. If you hear that your pet has cancer, you're immediately very fearful because you don't want to lose them, which is understandable. But fear is a very toxic emotion. We talk about toxins. We need to think about the emotions, and fear is very, very toxic. And your pet's going to pick up on that. Like, why does mom look at me and cry all the time now? You know, like, because you're sad, but your pet isn't sitting around worried about cancer. They just don't know why you're so sad. And it's normal to be sad, but you've got to also try to normalize your pet's life as much as possible and believe that the body can heal and believe that that there's hope for the pet, because the pet is going to pick up on all those energies because they are so tuned into it. It's almost spooky. I swear, sometimes my dog looks at me like he's just reading my mind, because that's what they do. They watch us, you know, they know our body language, and like, they get to where they almost know what you're going to do before you do it.
Yeah, they do. They do watch us, like, and they're watching us even when we don't realize that they're watching us, you know, like, I always notice when my pets are watching me, but like one of my dogs in particular, Boris, he is epileptic, and he has been with me, well, he's nine this year, so he's been with me a long time, and we've been through so many highs and lows together, and I feel so connected to him that I can't even begin to describe, you know, just how connected I feel. And part of our journey, which has been another eye-opener for me, is that when I used to be one of those people who was running around like crazy and really didn't cope with stress well at all, and his epilepsy gets worse when I am really, really stressed and stuff like that. And then for the past few years, because I've really worked hard on myself in terms of stress and management and, you know, just general health and everything, he has been so much better.
Yeah, very interesting.
It's so fascinating. And I, you know, he still has seizures from time to time. And sometimes I think, is it because I've been a bit stressed lately? Because I do still have the odd bout, you know, it's impossible not to kind of go through life and be stressed. But it gets to a point where if I go away for the night, he will always have a seizure if I am not at home. You know, like, it's happened so many times now because he gets stressed, you know, like, it's just different correlations that we've picked up on. And it is, I think that's definitely been one thing that's kind of amplified it to me, just how in tune they are with this, because he is so sensitive, and it's unfortunate that, you know, it just comes out in epilepsy.
But I think in other dogs, you know, it can come out in other more subtle ways. I see dogs that have, like, they have a tendency towards itchy skin, like that anxiety or stress can make them worse, because sometimes they get worse. We're like, well, why are they getting worse? You know, nothing else has really changed. Well, same thing. There's stress in the household. I think that can make any underlying condition worse. GI issues, diarrhea, anything. Every pet, I think, has kind of their weak point, so to speak, or the part of their body where stress will show up. Some it's in the gut, some in the skin. Your dog has the seizures. So I think, you know, maybe people, they stopped to pay attention like you did, like, wow, my pet symptoms are changing. What's going on for me? Rather than, oh, let's go to the vet and get, you know, more medications because my pet is itching worse or had another seizure.
Yeah. And it's tough to kind of make those connections because I didn't make them for a while until I'd learned about the connection between us and our pets. And, you know, when you think about it, it becomes quite obvious because, like, say if not even anything to do with like our pets, but even in the household, if there is something going on where the, you know, the air is a little bit not hostile, but you know what I mean? Like there's something in the air, like if there's been arguing or something's happened and, you know, such thing as like people walking on eggshells. If you walk into a room and the environment's not right, you can sense it, can't you? Like mm-hmm. even as people, you can feel what's been going on in this household. If you walk in and if there's toddlers running around, like in my case, it's chaos, but it's happy chaos. So we can feel that as humans. So to kind of like not think that our dogs can feel it too. It's just one of those things that becomes obvious when you kind of think about it, but until you do, you just kind of assume that they've got no idea what's going on.
Right. I think they're more tuned in because I think they're more instinctive than we are. Because I think a lot of our natural instincts have been kind of squashed by our modern culture, but I think the dogs have retained a lot more of that. So they're much more, I think, much more tuned into their natural instincts.
Yeah. And maybe as well, one thing that I always, you know, kind of think about is obviously we are aware of when we are in fight or flight mode. Whereas to our dogs, it's more of kind of like an instinctual thing. But even in terms of picking up on when we're in fight and flight, obviously we know if a threat is perceived or if it's real. And like you say, our dogs are just looking at us and wondering, you know, they know something is there, but they don't know what it is because they don't understand the way that we talk and we can't tell them. And I find that even sometimes when you get excited and like, you know, raise the energy in terms of excitement, it can kind of have the same impact on the dog. So one thing for us is we're in the kitchen and, you know, if we've got the music on and me and my toddler are dancing around, the dogs start, you know, jumping around and barking and going mad and getting all, but they get stressed, you know, like, but they get sort of like happy stress as well. So
yeah,
it just goes to show that even though we can't, they don't know exactly what's going on, they know that something is going on.
Yeah. And dogs will show signs of stress too. You know, they have different like stress releases, like animals shake to kind of shake off stress, or yawning is another one. But they're like, these are things that they do to try to help their body relax. Like I know my dog, like when we're training, like he does a yawn and a shake, like he'll do a big yawn and kind of shake his head. Like if he's confused or we're doing something new that makes him a little nervous, like I'm not sure quite what mom wants here. So he'll do that. So I know he's telling me he's a little stressed, a little confused. He's like, because he's a very willing dog to work. He's like, I want to do what mom wants, but I'm not quite sure here. Or we're in a new place he's never been before. He's a little nervous. So if you kind of pick up on those, and then, you know, when your dog is trying to help their own bodies relax, it's a good thing, you know, you can reward that, but then look at, well, what's going on? What can I do to help my dog relax more? So you can pick up on those signs. My dog will just give me a look. Sometimes it's just a puzzled look, like, what are we doing here? Like, what's going on? I don't understand. You know, you get so tuned into them that you kind of know, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can, if you pay attention to those things, you can pick up on those signals and then understand a little more. And again, you know, what can you do to change the current circumstances so that your dog is more relaxed? Because to be healthy, our bodies need relaxation. The fight or flight is useful if your life is really in danger, you know, you're running from a tiger or something. But then once that danger is done, your body should spend most of its time in the relaxed state. And it's the same for pets.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's tough, isn't it, as well, like you say, because a lot of us are so disconnected from from what's going on in general that it's hard to kind of pick it up. So would you say that for our pets to be really truly healthy, each aspect of their health in terms of physical, mental and emotional and stuff like that must be considered and supported as a whole, kind of like all at the same time? Or can you kind of achieve health by focusing on one aspect at a time, if that makes sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think addressing, you know, any of those issues will help, but I think for true healing, it takes all of them. And I think this is why sometimes in the patients I work with, you know, I can do similar treatments, say for three different cancer patients, similar types of cancer, because similar backgrounds, and some will do incredibly well and others just won't. They just can't seem to get on top of it. And I think that the reason is because a lot of the treatments we do are addressing the physical, that energetic piece kind of needs to be happening in the home. I mean, the things I can send people are more addressing the physical, but that energetic and emotional piece needs to happen in the home. And I do think that's the difference why some pets will, you know, do really well. And others just, you're doing the same thing. You think you have, you know, pretty good odds that you'll help them, and then they just don't thrive. You know, I've heard, you know, people say that people that have been diagnosed with cancer, they'll say, well, I forgave somebody I was angry at, or I was carrying a lot of anger, and they release those emotions and the cancer goes away. So I think that, again, that emotional toxicity can play a big role. And I also think that pets can hold past traumas just like people do. You know, we know that children that are abused, you know, can carry some of that into their adulthood that needs to be dealt with. Well, you know, I think pets that are abused, I think they can hold on to some of that emotional trauma. And it's hard, you know, like we can't get our pets to process things like people yeah. can. But if you're just aware of that and you just understand that the behavior you're seeing in your pet could be coming, it had nothing to do with you, but could be coming from a past experience, a past trigger. And, you know, just remember that and just love them through that. You know, I mean, dogs are so unconditionally loving, like, yeah, you know, and forgiving that, you know, just give them a little extra love and encouragement, you know, sometimes goes a long way, just like you would with a child.
Yeah, they are amazing, aren't they? And they are quite resilient, really, mm-hmm. in the face of everything that they have to deal with. So your work includes utilizing various different tools to help support pets with their health problems, like homeopathy and ozone and mistletoe, for example. So how do you determine which type of treatment would be appropriate for each individual pet?
Yeah, so it depends on the general state of the pet. Like, do they have a strong constitution, weak constitution? So I'll ask questions like, What's your pet's energy like? Do they, are they excited to go for walks? Is their activity the same? Are they excited? Do they just dive into their food bowl when you feed them? Because that vigorous appetite's a good sign of vitality. So if they have a stronger vitality, then like sometimes I'll start more things at once and say we have a diagnosis of a more aggressive cancer, but the pet right now has really good vitality, then I might do more things at once. Like we might do herbs and mistletoe, and I'll talk to people about ozone because that can actually be done at home. People can buy their own generator. But if a pet is very debilitated, an older pet, they're not eating. You can't get things orally into pets very well. They're not eating. It becomes a struggle. And I don't think any treatment should ever be a fight. If you're mm-hmm. fighting your pet to get a treatment done, you're causing enough stress, you're going to negate the benefit. So I don't ever recommend that. I steer away from anything orally until we know that we got the pet's appetite back, because that nutritional foundation is so important. And say you start putting a bunch of stuff in the pet's food, they're not eating well anyway. They're going to eat even less because they don't yeah. like all the new stuff. So the mistletoe injections, which we can, you know, send that to people and they can do the injections at home. The pet doesn't need to ingest it. And so that can sometimes get them feeling better. We talk about appropriate diet changes. Sometimes that helps. Then we get the pet eating better. Then we can start to add in more things. Cost sometimes enters into it. You know, we definitely work with people's budgets and help to prioritize. And sometimes just, you know, clients' wishes. Sometimes people are drawn to a certain modality more than another. You know, with mistletoe, for example, it's an injection. Some people are just not comfortable getting injections. They're just not going to do it. They don't have anybody problem with it, so they're not going to do it. So there's those, you know, those sorts of considerations as well.
Yeah. Oh, okie dokie. So it can be quite tough then at times as well. every single thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been doing it for a long time. So yeah, I've gotten pretty good at knowing what questions to ask and picking up on people's hesitation, or, you know, if they're enthused about a certain modality and really want to do it, or they're not sure, they're hesitant, they don't know about, you know, they're worried about changing the dog's diet or whatever, you know, pretty good at picking up on that stuff. So then we do the best we can. We give people the information and the resources, and then they have to work within their comfort level.
Yeah. So you have achieved some great results using this approach to care for pets who have not only had minor health disturbances, but also pretty serious conditions, as you've mentioned, like cancer. And you are considered a cancer specialist, aren't you, in this holistic health space. So can you describe what a typical cancer pathway would look like for a pet using your holistic approach? Would it be, you know, your typical treatment first kind of method like you'd see in conventional practice, or would you do something else first?
Yeah. So first of all, I always like to mention that I don't need an exact diagnosis to start to treat. So oftentimes, you know, a lump shows up and first thing people do, they take the pet into the vet and they're sticking needles in it or want to do a biopsy or want to schedule them for surgery right away to remove it. If you're taking this terrain approach, you don't need that definitive diagnosis. And in fact, I've seen many tumors blow up, get much bigger just by sticking a needle in to get some cells out and even removing them. So like smaller skin masses that aren't really causing a problem, but even if they could be something like mast cell tumors or squamous cell or some, you know, cancers that can get a bit locally invasive, if you go and just start removing them, sometimes the post-op regrowth, I see a lot of surgical regrowth, and that can be really, really super aggressive. And I think once you do surgery, you create scar tissue in the area and the body's own defenses can't get in there. So the first step is, you know, evaluating what we have. A lot of patients coming into me, probably most of them have a diagnosis, so I know what the cancer has been diagnosed with. But if they don't, we can still go ahead and treat. So my plan is not based on the specific type of cancer necessarily, more about where it's showing up in the body. I mean, obviously, if you had a tumor on the spleen or the liver, you wouldn't know it unless something like an ultrasound's been done. So we look at where it is in the body and what is the risk. Tumors in the belly, like at the spleen, can sometimes bleed. So that's, you know, an increased risk. So I do that assessment. And then we always start, I have a nutritionist on my team now, and everybody talks to her. Like, people have to be on board with doing the diet change. And that's a separate appointment to make sure that people really understand why that's important. And then she can give some specific guidance on how to get people started doing that. So the foundation, I think, is super, super important. Matter of fact, if people did only one thing, I'd say make sure you got the diet nailed down and stop putting the toxins in the body. And so the next step is stopping the toxicity, right? The vaccines and flea and tick and environmental toxins and all these things we've been we've been talking about, you have to start with that foundation. A lot of times people come into me and like, I heard about this mistletoe. I want the mistletoe. And it's like, nope, we're going to talk about the nutrition and all the other stuff first, because that's the conventional way of thinking is cancer showed up. Let's just attack the cancer. My approach is helping the body to manage the cancer, because if we can get the body healthy enough, and say we could even just keep cancer from progressing, the pet might be able to live with it and have a perfectly good quality of life. But if the approach is just attack the cancer, we're not going to have good results because we're not doing anything to support the body. And I think that's a negative energy. I think too, that we're putting into the process. If we're focusing on how can we get the pet's body so healthy that it can manage the cancer and improve their quality of life and focus on their quality of life, then I think it's a much more positive approach energetically. Yeah. And then from there, there's like some whole food additions that I use a lot, like mushrooms, medicinal mushrooms, turkey tail in particular is really good for cancer patients. I use a lot of CBD because if there's any pain or inflammation associated with like a tumor, it can help with that. It's calming. I just feel like there's a lot of benefits. If it's an older patient, they maybe have a little arthritis, can help calm them down, calm down that arthritis a little bit. And you know, the hemp plant, like many plants, does have known anti-cancer properties. So I use a lot of that. Make sure that the diet is really, really well balanced. You know, that the pet's getting adequate exercise. I do talk to people a bit about, you know, the energetics in the home environment. And then from there, I move into more cancer specific things. I use a lot of Chinese herbal medicine. So these are formulated in Chinese herbal medicine. Like anytime you have a tumor or growth show up, it's like a stagnation, it's like a stagnant energy. We want to get the energy moving in that part of the body. So there's different herbal blends that are more effective in different parts of the body. So I use that a lot. Mistletoe is probably the newest therapy I've used, but I've been using it for probably 7 or 8 years now. But I've definitely seen really good results with that. So if that's appropriate and people are interested, we might do that. I really like ozone therapy. I talk to people about that a lot. That's that can be done at home. People can buy their own ozone generator. So again, I talk, you know, what are people's comfort level? That's a bit more of an upfront investment. They can buy the equipment, but then they can do the treatments themselves. So I kind of then talk through some of these different modalities, get an idea of where people are at, what they're comfortable with, because it doesn't do any good for me to recommend something if people aren't going to do it. So I make sure they're comfortable. And then, you know, it's a process. You know, I'm looking for long-term, you know, improving quality of life. That's what I'm worried about. I know we don't want to see like a tumor on our pets, but if your pet has a tumor and they're acting perfectly fine and doing all their normal stuff, and we can just stop it right there, then that pet could live a good quality of life, you know, with the tumor. So I focus on quality of life. And so then it's a process. Then we're following up. We usually follow up in a few weeks to see how things are going. And then we track it going forward. If we're seeing a progression of the cancer, you know, things aren't going the way we'd hoped, well, then we're going to make changes. The nice thing about holistic approaches is there's so many other options. You can move into other modalities like homeopathy, different herbal blends. There's so much you can do or change, or in conventional medicine, you're pretty limited to chemo, radiation, or surgery. So we're, you know, constantly evaluating the pet. It's a constant process, keeping them comfortable. It's very, you know, individualized therapy.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating, because I think when you do tend to think that, you know, if you hear just the word cancer, then you just think chemotherapy and that's basically all that's available. So I bet there's many, many pet parents don't even know there is a different thing that you can even try if your pet gets cancer. And I imagine it is pretty difficult for a pet parent to deal with as well, because everybody associates cancer with death as well, which is, you know, just another way that people think. So do you have any kind of success stories that you can share with us from your cancer patients?
Sure. I have one. So one of the toughest cancers I think we treat is osteosarcoma, which is bone cancer, because it tends to be quite aggressive and is very, it tends to metastasize really easily. It can spread to the lungs and other parts of the body. So it's really challenging. So I had one dog, this was a few years ago, that had an osteosarcoma in his radius, the front leg, and it was growing. I mean, you could definitely see it there, and he was quite sore. They were even considering amputation because he was so sore on the leg. And but then after probably about 3 to 4 months of treatments, we were doing, this is when I had a, after I sold my big clinic in Colorado, I had a smaller home clinic, but I kept doing these specialized modalities there. And so we were doing IV ozone treatments, and he was getting mistletoe and herbs. It was just a great pet parent. I mean, she did all the diet stuff and all of that. And his lump completely went away, and he was 100% sound.
Wow.
Probably took the better part of a year to really turn it around. But what really surprised me, he was a relatively young dog. I think he was probably around four and a half when we started working with him. But sadly, she kept doing the treatments, but sadly, it did come back after about 2 years. It was quite a while. And I wanted to mention this case because, number one, we know the treatments can work. The question is, why did it come back though? You know? And when I talked to the owner afterwards, you know, she said to me, I was always afraid it would come back. So again, we're back to that fear. And so, I mean, this is nothing I can prove, but I do believe that her injecting that fear into the situation influenced the pet's body in some way. Now, I can't prove that, and some people might think that's just cuckoo, but I really do believe it, because again, on the physical level, this dog was sound, and they lived up in the mountains in Colorado. I mean, she sent videos of this dog running in the snow chasing deer. He wasn't lame at all. You couldn't see any evidence of the lump, like on the purely physical level. This dog was healed, and yet it came back. So this just speaks, I think, to the importance of addressing the energetic and emotional piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the thing is, though, it's like you see all over social media, especially cancer survivors, and now they even have cancer thrivers, where people have been, this is people, not pets, probably pets as well, but I've not seen many of those, but people have been diagnosed with a terminal cancer in various parts of their body, and yet they're living like years beyond their estimated time that they've got left. But their whole attitude towards life, they're going out, they're doing challenges, they're kind of, you know, being there for the kids, and just their whole attitude and energy to life is so kind of like magnetic, even for somebody who doesn't have, you know, cancer. Like, you watch these videos and you think, I want to do that, you know, that's, you know, it's making me want to get up and, I don't know, bike a million miles or whatever it is they're doing. But it just goes to show that the mentality of your situation, like if you think the worst is going to happen, then you're just kind of attracting that negative energy into your space, and you know, that's ultimately what you could get. Whereas if you decide to kind of take a different mindset and believe in the process and kind of just shoot for the moon, then, you know, amazing things can happen.
Right. It's like, envision your dog as being healthy and vibrant and running and doing all the things it loves to do, rather than focusing on, oh my gosh, my dog has cancer. You know, acknowledge it, make a plan to deal with it, but then what are you visualizing in your mind? You know, that should be around health and wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you are familiar with, for anyone that's listening, if anyone is familiar with meditation and visualization and that kind of stuff, then if you've ever tried it, you know that it is powerful and it does help. Kind of, it definitely helps me. Like, I use meditation and manifestation and stuff like that to help with my own stress levels, and it has been one of the game changers in how I cope and deal with stress from daily life. So, you know, I do definitely do believe.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I do as well. I I do as well. You know, it's like believing that there's more to our existence here than just these bodies. There's, you know, more of a force, whether you want to call it the universe or God or spirit or however, you know, you want to address it. There's a power that you can always tap into to help manifest good in your life and in your pet's life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So coming back to the emotional and mental health and well-being of our pets, how important, or should I say, how much do these two aspects impact the overall health? So can it be that you are implementing all of the right things in terms of nutrition and reducing the exposure to toxins and making sure they've got adequate exercise and stuff like that, but you can still find they're struggling from a physical problem because their emotional and mental health are still struggling in some way?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely think so. And again, I think this goes back to stress. You know, think about ourselves. If we are emotionally not in a good place, we're sad about something or worried about something, then our body again is in that sympathetic fight or flight mode. And it's the same for your pet. If they're not in a good emotional place, their body is going to be in that sympathetic mode, that stress mode, and they cannot heal there. It doesn't matter how many physical things you do to support them. If they're feeling this stress, like I always feel it in my gut, like if I'm getting stressed, like, oh, my gut just clenches up. I can feel my stomach just contract. I know I need to relax, take a deep breath, go for a walk, or just, you know, chill. It's much harder, like I said, for our pets to communicate this to us. But if we're not meeting their emotional and mental needs, then their body's going to stay more in that sympathetic mode. And then all the physical things just aren't going to be as effective.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it really is influential, isn't it, in the overall health and well-being. Okay. So our pets are more likely to absorb more toxins in from the environment that they're in, aren't they, compared to humans, which they then have to detox, which is part of the problem. So do you find in practice that pets commonly have high toxic loads in their system, which then require a more focused detoxification kind of schedule? Or do you find that dogs can usually kind of detoxify naturally when their diet and lifestyle is optimized?
Yeah, so I definitely agree that they absorb more from the environment. They don't walk around with shoes. They just have their paws exposed. So if they're walking, say, in weed killer or something like that, then they go inside later and they're licking it off their feet. They're getting a direct exposure to that chemical. Plus, dogs have their noses down, sniffing in all kinds of stuff. And anything they breathe in, even fumes, you know, that's going into their circulation. It's very close to the brain. So any sort of neurotoxin. So I do think they have a high exposure. I don't do a lot of toxicity testing because I've just found that, like, they just never know whether, not that the labs are doing anything dishonest, but how do we really know what exactly is a toxic level? I tend to not get super hung up on numbers, on diagnostic tests. There's times where I think testing is valuable, but when it comes to toxins, again, it's about education, letting people know what the toxins are and what they need to be avoiding, and remembering that the body can detox. And so if we support the body properly with whole food nutrition, we're supporting those detoxification pathways. So then it becomes important to not overload the body. That's why, you know, we may not be able to control every environmental toxin that our pets are exposed to, but that's what makes it really important to control the things we can control. So make sure the diet's clean and we're not doing all the pharmaceuticals and we're not adding in all these other things, because then their body's going to stand a much better chance of being able to eliminate toxins. Now, adding in things like a little liver support, like there's some herbs, milk thistle, dandelion root, doing some like additional liver flushing, or, you know, some herbs to help with liver support, doing that, like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 days out of the month, just, you know, on a regular basis to help support those cleansing mechanisms. Cause we do just live in a very toxic world, unfortunately. Yeah. I think things like that are a good idea. Make sure the pet has good, clean water filtered if necessary. So kind of approaching it from that way, but, you know, just recognizing that, you know, toxins are huge. I mean, I've seen dogs that start seizuring after a walk to the park, and I'll ask, you know, well, do they put chemicals down there? Oh yeah, we saw the guy spraying when we were there, and they said it was safe, you know, for the pets. But those things aren't safe. So I think it's just really important for people to be aware that those are really, there's some really potent chemicals out there that it's best to avoid as much as can.
Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of things do pet parents need to consider when trying to reduce their pet's exposure to toxins in the environment? So it's things like being the grass is being sprayed, and in the home especially, what kind of things can pet parents, you know, kind of swap out?
Yep. So home cleaning products, using natural cleaning products. I use vinegar, essential oils, things like that, or natural soaps. No chlorine, nothing with any strong chemicals. Things like air fresheners, like these artificial air fresheners, I think they smell disgusting to begin with, but, you know, use your natural essential oils if, you know, you want to use something to freshen the scent in your home. I'm going to get an essential oil diffuser. So you're just putting that natural scent in the air. I think, you know, sadly, a lot of fabrics can be toxic. They can have flame retardants. So even your furniture, your carpeting, flooring, drywall, I think all of those things, it's pretty rare to find like completely natural building. You know, there's some people doing it, but most homes are not that. So obviously you can't necessarily just tear everything out of your home, but just be aware of that. If you're buying new furniture or you're buying bedding for your dog, you know, can you get something that's organic, that's a natural fabric? It's cotton or wool or something, and it's not polyester or something synthetic. So as natural as you can keep. Same with toys. Anything plastic, potentially toxic. Anything with dyes on it, potentially toxic. So being really careful to use things or get things that are as natural as possible, at least natural fabrics, and ideally organic, because unfortunately things like cotton are also sprayed with glyphosate. So it's hard to get away from it unless it's cotton. But, you know, look for and support, you know, companies that are really trying to put out clean products for pets.
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough when everything mm-hmm. that is so easily accessible in terms of cost and things like that is actually part of the problem, or could be part of the problem. Yeah. For many of us, it's a tough time to be alive. So I suppose in order to get a real good picture of how healthy or unhealthy our pets actually are, sort of from a conventional perspective, would require several different tests and things. Now, you've already briefly mentioned that you don't, you know, necessarily need to work with the diagnoses, or, you know, testing is kind of like something that's not necessary either. So do you kind of not recommend having all of these different tests? Is it more kind of like just work on the diet and the lifestyle and nourish the body and see what happens kind of thing from your approach?
Yeah, I think it's more important to look at how the pet is doing and how the pet is feeling than focusing on numbers on tests. Now, I do sometimes find it valuable, like say a pet has started drinking more water, and it would be, you know, kind of, it's helpful to know, well, is that, do we have kidney issues or adrenal issues? Or sometimes dogs do that out of habit. There's kind of a behavioral thing. So sometimes the diagnostic testing can help sort that out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, say we run a panel on a, say it's a senior dog, it's an older dog, and pet parent just wants to do some routine blood work. and those kidney values are raised a little bit. Well, conventional vets, I mean, oftentimes you're like, oh my gosh, your pet's in kidney failure and you got to put him on this prescription diet. And it's all this drama around it. Whereas I look at it like, well, that's part of the aging process to a degree. If those values go up a little bit, it just means the kidneys aren't working as well as they did when the dog was two. But then again, I go back to, how's the dog acting? Oh, they're running around doing everything they love to do and eating great. I say, great, that we could continue to monitor these values, but we don't need to get so excited about, oh my gosh, my dog's in kidney failure. Because if your dog was in kidney failure, he would be acting sick. So yeah, the conventional side, they focus solely on those values and can really panic people. So I think that, you know, I can treat pets because the foundations of health are pretty similar. I think I could treat most any pet, at least to start to support their body without a definitive diagnosis. But the numbers do sometimes help. I don't like allergy testing, just putting that out there, because lots of people do it. And the reason I don't like allergy testing is because I just haven't seen it come back accurate, meaning that I've talked to so many people that say, well, I did this allergy testing, and supposedly the only thing my dog can eat is alligator and kangaroo and silaging, you know? So I just don't see good correlation. I think there's much more to the picture, and I think it's about inflammation. Yeah. So again, it's very, I've seen so many people, they focus on those allergy test results for the whole life of the pet. And then pets end up being malnourished because they're not getting a well-rounded diet, because there's only one or two things that they can supposedly feed them, when really the issue is, what else is inflaming the pet? What else is going on in that pet's routine? All these other things we've been talking about, the toxins, the emotions, and all of that. What else is going on that's causing this pet to be ill? Because there's this way overblown focus on food allergies. And I think it's really rare that that's the main root of the issue. Can dogs do better on certain foods than others? Yes. Have some mild sensitivities? Yes. But to have that as the root cause of things, I think that's rare. And we have to look again at the whole picture. So that's just an example of when I think if we get too hyper-focused on test results, it can lead us down the wrong rabbit hole.
Yeah, I agree. I see a lot of dogs that have these food sensitivities and so-called allergies. And I know pet parents who have submitted the same dogs, a sample from the same dog to the same company twice and had two different reports come back from the same company. Or they've sent it off to five different companies and each one's come back with a different set of foods. And then, you know, you get a long list of foods they can't eat, and then when you do feed the foods that it says they're okay with, they're still kind of like having a reaction, and then it becomes hard to try and build a recipe because there's nothing left to play with, because all the lists have kind of like removed everything, and then you kind of stuck with this battle because then the pet parents don't want to try anything new because the test says it's not allowed. And but even though, you know, sometimes, well, most of the time, itching doesn't immediately stop anyway, does it? Because itching is to do with an overreactive immune response, which has been caused by either problems with the gut or something else. So, and for the body to heal, it takes time. It can take a long time as well, can't it? So, you know, you could feed them a nice diet, which they're still going to itch on for a little bit, but trying to get people to understand that symptoms don't go away within 24 hours is quite difficult as well, isn't it? And that's again probably largely because we're used to going out and getting a pill, which worked kind of like immediately.
It takes time. And I tell people, if you're gonna stabilize skin, you know, because I see a lot of itchy skin, I'm sure you hear about this a lot too, which I think a lot of times that's also linked to the gut and something like a leaky gut, inflamed, you know, gut inflammation. So we have to be resolving that's a big part of the picture. But I tell people it's going to be several months.
Yeah.
And the itching is usually the last thing to go away, which is the first thing most people have to go away, because like, my dog's driving me crazy, they're itching. But when we start to see, usually we see first, we see the skin healing, we see the scabs going away, we see the coat growing back. If we're having success, The skin and hair coat are looking healthier, but that darn itching will persist. It's like the last thing, and maybe it's somewhat like habitual for them. I think there's lots of reasons for that. But it does, it takes time and patience, and people are conditioned. I just want the pill. I just want this to go away. But true healing takes time, and it is possible. And people just have to be diligent and stick it out.
Yeah. And I do find as well, in my experience, that a lot of the problem is like a lot of the dogs that I kind of help with nutrition and things like that are already being fed fresh food. So, you know, you've got pet parents who are going out and they're feeding fresh food because that's what everybody says is the best thing for our pets. And, you know, it's not like they're doing anything wrong. But then again, we've got sort of like commercially made fresh food, which has got these synthetic vitamins and minerals in and stuff like that. And that's kind of like what the missing piece is, because it's not wholesome, natural nutrition. So you've got all these dogs eating fresh food, but the diet is not adequate enough. So then they're still struggling because they're still missing pieces from the puzzle where, you know, like the body can't heal itself unless it's got everything that it needs, can it? Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, one of the things that we focus on as well.
Yep. It's a challenge, but I absolutely agree that the diet has to be balanced, because we see the same thing a lot. People realize, okay, I shouldn't be feeding this kibble, and they start to cook like meals like they would eat for their dog, but they're not balancing the diet for a carnivore. That's the other thing. Dogs are carnivores. They need to be eating a meat-based diet, and I think primarily balanced with animal products, you know, organs and bone and those sorts of things. That's what dogs need to be eating, not what people eat, and not a plant-based diet.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Okay, so finally, my last question. It's been a wonderful, wonderful talk so far. So we'll wrap it up with this. If you could boil it all down to one thing that pet parents can do today, or just one bit of advice for how they can be the best advocate for their pet in terms of supporting their health, what would it be?
Definitely the nutrition piece. You got to do the diet. You just got to be feeding them properly. If you don't do that, yeah, I think you could waste a lot of money on other things. You know, the diet and the close second would be get out and let them, you know, have some fun and be a dog and have fun with your dog. That's really what I think brings them a lot of joy and helps keep their body relaxed and in that parasympathetic state for healing.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. Thank you ever so much, Dr. Judy. Okay, so everyone who's listening, I will put some links on to Dr. Judy's website if you want to go and have a little nosy in the show notes as usual. So yeah, you can do that. And thanks again, Dr. Judy, for sharing your time with us and contributing to the holistic pet space in general. I know that there are many more pets who have benefited from having you here.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure, and it's very nice meeting you and chatting with you today.
Thank you very much. We'll speak to you soon.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. Don't forget to check out the caption for any links discussed here today. And please, if you enjoyed the show, follow along and listen for free on your favorite podcast app. If you have any questions or would like to share your story, feel free to email me at mydogmademedoitnaturally@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Purpose of this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be substituted as advice from a veterinarian or other professional. It does not form a client relationship with me, the host, or any guest speakers, and any information is not intended to and does not diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. And my guests express our own views, thoughts, and opinions as individuals, and the podcast neither endorses or opposes the views, products, or services discussed here. If your pet is ill, always seek advice from your veterinarian. I am not a veterinarian, and I do not treat disease or offer medical advice.